Mr. Chairman, if we're able to implement management programs that do that, that is our intent. And once again, it's to our advantage as well, since over half the king salmon spawn above the border. It's to our advantage to ensure that we have fish up there to see.
Well, I think most people, once it's brought their attention to facts of life, not all, but most people, you know, as long as you have a proper educational program around, reluctantly agree to that.
Yes.
Please proceed. I'm just, are you?
Once again, we see the need for additional legal assistance. This treaty is coming together fairly quickly now. And again, we just want to ensure that Alaska gets what's best for Alaskans through this treaty process.
Mr. Chairman.
You have the floor, Senator.
I was just reminded by Senator Adams not to interrupt Mr. Meacham's brief report on these categories that you had shown an interest in addressing false bass. I think that's an interest of Senator Adams and mine, and I know we do have a 10 o'clock session, but I just wanted to bring that.
Why don't we bring up false pass now with your statement? I'm going to stay here and record for the members. Anything else that's in your presentation, won't belabor it, so they can go down. And, of course, you'll have the subcommittee, and I suppose most of us having interest in some parts. You'll stimulate us with your presentation to ask questions a bit later. But if you go into the false pass so that Senator Adams, and in all of us, particularly the
sure.
Senator Hoffman, we're just questioning what you think is now, I believe, going to happen with the decision by Fish and Game Board. I saw in the newspaper you found something to hang your hat on for bringing about change with the escapement question. You've tagged a greater amount of the fish been caught there in false pass that should have been gone in the river system, so on. Anything you can say that would give us some optimism. You know, as you know, 7,000 individuals signed a question, and those figures, I think, probably are significant.
Well, they certainly are, and there's little question about the significance of the board decision. For the information of the panel here, the board is meeting. They have received a petition from the Yukon asking that the board reconsider their decision on false pass, the chum cap specifically, in false pass. The board will have a teleconference hearing on this afternoon, which basically it'll be starting at 1 o'clock in my office, or in my auditorium, down at the subboard building here for anyone that's interested in setting in. So at that time, they will take up the issue of the whether they will reconsider. The first step on this is the acceptance of the petition to reconsider it, which will be the decision here today. If they decide that they do or will rehear it, then they'll establish the normal advertised period to let people get their act together and come together and prepare testimony and accept testimony on the issue again at some future date. So it's something that will be dealt with. We'll know the answer to that by this afternoon.
On that issue, I guess I have some questions of the commissioner. Given the fact that the Board of Fish set a cap this last season in false pass, and that cap was exceeded by 200,000 fish this last summer. And given the fact that your department has come up with a new mathematical error regarding the 1987 study, what do you plan to improve the credibility of your chief fishery scientist's office and your division of commercial fisheries, which is at an all-time low in Western Alaska today?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that to begin with, the analysis that was done on this and the published report is several years old. I think it's a credit to the department that, one, we discovered that there was an error in this because the information had in fact been put out as a publication study, as you may recall, was done in 1987. And so I think that from our standpoint, I think the department acted very responsibly in terms of calling attention to the fact that there was an area there and trying to make that adjustment. I think in terms of certainly some questions in everyone's mind about when it was in fact flagged and why wasn't it put before the board at the January meeting. Basically, I think that that's symptomatic of the involvement in the department in a lot of areas. And the chief fisheries scientist was involved in North Pacific Council activities. He's assigned to the my chief representative on the Scientific and Statistical Committee of the North Pacific. During most of December, he was involved with those activities on this. The biometrician, in fact, discovered the error on this, had flagged it as a potential error, but had not really indicated what the significance of this was. So until we had the opportunity to, in fact, analyze the significance of that error on this, which occurred in January, after the board had already reviewed the earlier petition. I think that it was indeed an unfortunate incident or oversight on this. We've had peer review of the information that was involved here. It was not just done as an in-house thing. It was done by outside peer reviewers as well. And the error still got through the system. So I think that we've got a good system of quality control. In this particular situation, it failed. It wasn't just within the department.
Well, one area that is clearly in the department's preview is the management of the decisions of the Board of Fish, and the Board of Fish does not sit down and decide things for their health. They set the caps in False Pass this last summer, and it seems incomprehensible to me that the cap could be exceeded by 200,000. 200,000 fish this last summer.
It wasn't 200,000, Mr. Chairman.
That was the information. What was it then?
No, it was 145,000, I think.
Well, that still is substantial, wouldn't you agree?
The way the fisheries operate out there on this, I would consider to be a substantial overrun on this, but in terms of control, my analysis of this, it occurred in a very brief period of time in a very isolated part of that fishery.
I understand but my question to you is, what is the department doing to ensure that these type of activities don't happen again?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the best way to answer that is that with every piece of information, we get a little smarter. And with that particular issue, I think that we'll certainly look at conservative management as we approach caps and be sure that we've got correct information in hand prior to making extensions of fishing time. And I think that that's about the best that I can guarantee you at the present time.
Well, it seems to me that it may be the best that you can guarantee, but the state pays for competent management. And, you know, if you're just learning a little bit at a time, maybe you need to look at the qualifications of the people that are doing the job and hire people so that they aren't on a learning curve and you are learning at increments. We need competent staff. We're talking about a resource here that affects thousands of people's lives, and the people that I represent in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, many of them made less than $10,000 this last season because of the mistakes. Partly because of some of the mistakes that your department has made, and the people that are directly benefiting, rightly or wrongly, are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. But the people that are being affected can barely pay for food and clothing. And I think it's atrocious when these type of activities happen And we can't afford to have the department being on a learning curve. We pay them high dollars to have the proficiency to manage this resource.
What is going to be the department's recommendation as far as the false pass interception for the catch, because of the fact that you have areas in the Nome coastal areas cannot even commercial fish or was late even in subsistence fishing?
Mr. Chairman, I think that from the standpoint of the new information on this, we consider the information to be very significant and we'll be prepared to tell the board that today. The significance of it, of course, is related to the primarily to the Kuskokwim, where the number has increased fairly substantially in terms of the potential intercept out there. In terms of the rest of the northwestern area, the significance of the air is relatively small. But in the case of the Kuskokwim, there's no question about it that it is a significant number.
Those that wish to go check in the center, you have 4 centers.
Another subject, we're up at the Falls Pass, but we discussed today the fish stock and the hatcheries today. I attended the salmon marketing strategy show the other day, and health-wise, I was pleased that I was not on that particular committee because I would have had blisters on my back from the padding of each other's that was on that particular committee. I looked at the recommendations. I find that there is not any recommendations that we should have put in there to sell the fish as far as to corrections or the 55 school districts or within its budget process that we'd have somebody go and look at the food chain domestically, like in the Safeway, a Cars, or what have you. Your agency going to help as far as the marketing strategy that you participate, or is your motto going to be for this particular committee, I'll show you a fish if you show me $10 million? That's all I got out of this show the other day.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think there was a lot more to be gained from that report than was indicated, but from our standpoint on this, as I indicated, my role on this is to help in the quality area. The department is not involved in the marketing of fish, other than trying to assure that we in fact harvest the quality product on this. I think that in terms of marketing activities, that's certainly within ASME's bailiwick, that's certainly within Commerce and Economic Development, and that's certainly within the industry's prerogatives on this. And it's going to take all three, in my estimation, to in fact do the job. I think that from our standpoint, we want to ensure that we, in fact, harvest quality fish. I think that's kind of the beginning of the whole process right there.
One area that I'd like to go back to is your brown shirt coordination efforts. I think that might have merit for consideration, but I find it a little bit troubling because of the problems that that brown shirts even are having today. We went ahead and had budget not a study done on what's happening within that department, and they need to concentrate on their activities instead of trying to concentrate coordinating efforts with you people. They need to get back and do their job. It seems as though they're under a lot of a fire presently. But if you do continue to do this, I wonder how you will ensure that the biologists don't become cops in the field. I think that is a grave area that can do further damage, not only to the department, to your department, but to the Department of Public Safety. We don't need biologists as cops in the field. We need to concentrate on managing the resources, which is one of our primary responsibilities.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I certainly agree with the Senator on this. That I'm not anxious to turn my staff into quote cops on this. I think that our presence in the field, where we in fact see and observe violations. I think that it's the state's benefit to have a well-trained staff that can, in fact, react to that particular situation.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. How responsive has the federal government been in providing federal support to the advisory committees and the regional councils?
They haven't been responsive, in my estimation.
Thank you.
You can continue, Mr. Meacham.
I have one last item with regard to the Yukon treaty negotiations I'll bring up, and that deals with the way that we're solving equity with the Yukon Treaty. Now, the Pacific Salmon Treaty in general calls for equity approach, which means that, each country receives benefits in accordance with its salmon production. Now, in the southeastern component of U.S.-Canada, this has been interpreted by a number of parties as meaning that the fisheries need to be changed, discontinued, so forth. It tends to be a disruptive approach. Now, on the Yukon River, the approach that we're using is one of solving equity by the government, and in this particular instance, the federal government, providing a value of fish taken by Alaska fishermen that originated in Canada, taking this value and putting it into an enhancement fund. And this enhancement fund then would be used by Yukon panel to the benefit of fisheries for both countries. And that's just an entirely different approach than is being used in Southeast. So this enhancement fund then would go towards various rehabilitation enhancement related activities to help both parties rather than just one party.
And your science now is pretty well indicated and support your testimony of where the true spawning and production takes place.
Mr. Chairman, it's better for
chum
the king and Chinook than it is for the chum. We have this general idea, well, it's more than that in the case of Chinook salmon. On chum salmon, we have a much lesser understanding, but it still appears that a substantial fraction of the fall chum and the Yukon spawn above the border.
Thank you.
40%.
Do you have anything more to initiate at this time?
Not with regard to U.S.-Canada activities either in Southeast Alaska or in Yukon.
Do you have anything you wish to go into? What about the relationship with the Russians and so on? Is there anything here?
I can give you a very brief update on some other international activities. One is the directed high seas salmon fishery that has in the past been conducted by Japan. This fishery actually started in the 1930s when Japanese gill netters moved into the Bristol Bay area. In 1952, the International North Pacific Fisheries Commission was established, which included Japan, Canada, and the United States to regulate that high seas fishery. INPFC was renegotiated in 1978 and then again in 1985 and 86. And through all these renegotiations, Alaska was benefited in terms of fishery terms, and the Japanese high seas fishery was pushed closer and closer to their own stocks in Asian waters. Now, more recently, the United States has started working with the Soviet Union to put together a four-way salmon agreement, and this agreement includes the original INPFC countries of U.S., Canada, Japan, and it adds then Russia, as things now stand. This treaty has been put together now and basically awaits signature. One of the problems that exists with the State Department is who signs now for the Soviet Union or for Russia, but it's essentially a done deal. And when in effect, this will eliminate all directed salmon fishing on the high seas, which is a major step forward in the state of Alaska. Now, there is another gillnet fishery on the high seas conducted by Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. This high seas drift net fishery is directed, in most instances, at squid, tuna, and other bellfish. And these are the nets that you typically read about as being 30 to 40 miles in long, in length. Now, the fisheries conducted here are supposed to be directed at non-salmon species, but we know, as a matter of fact, that fishermen conducting these fisheries do, in fact, step in, move into waters that tend to be cooler and have a large number of salmon, and in fact that they target on salmon. Millions of pounds of illegally caught salmon have been seized, as a matter of fact, a million more have been documented moving to world markets. The area of the high seas involved is actually larger than the continental United States, so it's a major, major geographical area. Now, Alaska has worked very hard to get through the United Nations a resolution that would outlaw drift netting. And in fact, we've been successful now that there is a moratorium that's to go into effect.
Mr. Chairman? Japan, Mr. Chairman, on that issue?
Yes.
Alaska may have been involved, but last session at this table near the close of the session when we were talking about additional dollars for lobbying efforts, I proposed to put in money to lobby the UN to fight this very issue. There wasn't any, and I had to go to the chairman this last fall, and he was cooperative in funding at least three positions to address the false pass issue. The state was present, but very, very limited. I think that the amount of effort that could have been placed on this issue could have been much more. I think much of the success on the high seas drift net issue was because of the involvement of many people in Western Alaska. We had funded some 8 or 9 people. We went around and went into groups and went and talked to many of the 160 nations that were there. And I think for the 5 to 7 day effort by the people from Western Alaska, predominantly people from Western Alaska, within that week, the Japanese had announced that they were going to cease and desist a year earlier. You know, I think that the state of Alaska may try to claim credit for that issue, but I think most of the credit has to go to Western Alaska and some support from the chairman himself, because there was very little presence and very little lobbying effort by the state of Alaska, who professes to be an owner state.
Yes, I would agree, Mr. Chairman. There's no question that the residents of rural Alaska, especially Western Alaska, did play a very, very key role. There's no question. I'm glad you put that on the record. It is the case that basically it appears we're successful in eliminating, and when I say we, I speak for all the people of the state who were involved in eliminating gill netting now in the high seas. Again, Japan was the first nation to fall in line here, and others are coming along as well.
I'd like to interject something, Senator Hoffman. When we get into the continuing arguments about subsistence and so on, I think you ought to remember the contribution that some rural people made. You will. I think it's by being part of their records in these arguments toward making certain that there are some fish to talk about for division. There might well have been a lot less fish to talk about, and there have been less fish to date to talk about because of these high seas. I think it's a good point to make that there's no one way. There was really a contribution made here, an initiation of, you know, and we have found in the past, dealing with the Japanese a long time ago, my source was Senator Tillian, but that they had backed down on the chum fishery in the Unalakleet area because it was a report of rural people, where they went back down on sports fisheries use and so on. I don't know if that's true or not, but I can well remember these conversations. I'd rather suspect it's true. But I think they probably were very effective.
Yes, they were. And as I'm asking, I'm very, very pleased to see the progress that has been made. I mean, it's been many, many, many years that many people have worked to eliminate these high sea salmon interceptions, both directed and incidental and illegal. And I really think it's finally happening.
You may be able to use them as a future resource to maintain or to further reduce erosion of salmon stocks and so on. I think that's a good relationship. I hope it's being developed.
The last item I'll discuss is the Central Bering Sea Donut Hole activities. Basically, the Bering Sea Donut Hole is an area in the Bering Sea that's outside both the U.S. and the USSR 200-mile zone. And it comprises about 10% of the area of the entire Bering Sea. Trawl fisheries in that area are the primary fisheries, and those are for pollock. Primary countries are Japan, South Korea, Poland, mainland China. The reported catches for those fleets total about 300,000 metric tons in 1986, but grew very rapidly to nearly 1.5 million metric tons here in 1989. Since that time, catches have fallen off very dramatically. And indications are that we've exceeded the overfishing limit for the stocks involved the past 3 or 4 years by 40% to 60% due to the unregulated nature within that area. It's an ongoing area of negotiation. In fact, Dave Benton, who's been involved with this for a number of years, as well as with the salmon treaties, is back in Washington right now working on.
Who is that?
David Benson, Director of International Fisheries with the department.
Yeah.
So this issue is yet to be resolved, but it's being worked on. I think there are some reasons for hope, just from the standpoint that stocks are so low within that area, the incentive to continue fishing is being dramatically reduced.
Thank you for your initiation and bringing us up to date in a modest way. You have floor.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've got just a couple of cleanup items here on this. We talked about federal preemption, we talked about an ELK implementation. One federal action that I had not mentioned was the Endangered Species Act and that impact on the department. We're all aware of the spotted owl controversy in the Northwest and the impact on the lumber industry down there. We're aware that Greenpeace made a run at the National Marine Fisheries Service on sea lions that could very well have adversely affected our Gulf pollock fishery. On this, the state did intervene on that particular case, and we were successful in being able to continue the fishery for the current season. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg on this one, as I see it at the present time. We've got certain species, races of salmon in the Columbia and the Snake River that may bring us into this. Certainly, fall Chinook stocks on the Columbia are one of the races that could impact us up here, depending on the designation of critical habitat. But my only reason for raising this is that this is an area that we simply have to be involved in both the biological analysis that goes into making the determination of the status, the listing process, and ultimately the recovery process that's associated with the species that is listed. We simply cannot afford to back away from this. Our involvement with marine mammals up here, the potential for major disruptions of harvesting of.
Do you have somebody in the commissioner's office or somebody?
Yes, I do.
Sort of already monitoring?
This is Ron Somerville's, one of his areas of expertise on this.
I suppose a report directly to the committee on that issue would be wise.
We would be glad to provide that.
If you have something that you can put in writing, at least initiate further
right
for information, I think it'd be wise.
The last issues are two issues off of your letter that I don't think we had spoken to at the
yep.
time.
Yep.
Item number three, you talked about the privatization of Fred Hatchery and what with Fred following that. Basically, the direction that we have for the Fred division now is technical support for the private sector. We'll be doing a lot of research work supporting the private nonprofits as they proceed with culturing salmon. Stream rehabilitation is another area that we're trying to expand our activities in. I mentioned mariculture earlier on this and the needs that we see developing there. And mitigation, which was the large chunk of federal dollars that we'd indicated was part of the Fred Division's increase associated with U.S. Canada on that. So basically, those are the four priorities that I see for the Fred Division in the near term. Item number four, you asked about plans to reorganize the department. I have no plans to do major reorganizations of the department. That decision, I think, is contingent upon ultimately the funding levels that we're working, we have to work with on this.
Carl, I strongly question the competence or the knowledge of those who suggested the organization throughout or that are on this board of the organization. I don't know much going to come out of it, but I just wanted to have any response that you might have on their recommendations, if in fact they've had any.
They have not completed the report on my department. I have not seen that. I'm not sure what. So I've received nothing to respond to at the present time, Mr. Chairman.
I can think of three or four of these major efforts by people. Then it appoints people, no particular knowledge and background experience by the prejudice to start giving recommendations. I don't think this group is any change from the pattern that's developed over two generations.
I do see some need, even at our present funding level, as I've indicated in our budget presentation here, that the need for some redirection of some of our activities, because we've got new challenges coming on and we've got to respond to them. The major one, of course, as I've tried to outline here today, I think has been the federal involvement in the state management process. I think that's one of the key areas. But other than that, Mr. Chairman, I hope we've given you some perspective before we're coming from on our budget this year. And if the committee has got further questions, we'd be glad to answer.
Yes, I just have one. Senator, you have a question.
Just a comment, I guess. It seems to me that in the presentation, we did touch on the problems of dual management. But it seems to me that the question at hand is the prevention of the dual management problem that we're facing. That seems to me to be the most important issue facing the department, if not the state, and you don't even list that as a major issue in your office. It's not listed as a major issue in public communications. It's not even listed as a major issue in wildlife conservation. Instead, major issues in wildlife conservation are fish and game management coordination with the federal government. It seems as though we should have as a major issue trying to resolve the issue. The only place that I see it even mentioned is on page 40 under major issues, under all Alaskan eligible for subsistence. You say develop a new subsistence law that limits eligibility has also become a significant issue. in the division, but it's more than a division issue. I think it's it should be a department issue, and it should be clearly, it seems to me, to be a major state issue. And I guess why do you feel that it's a major issue? And if so, why haven't you listed it as one of your major issues to be addressed?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think if you recall that this particular issue was removed from the department last year by the governor's office. And basically that responsibility for that, the resolution of that issue was vested in the third floor.
The subsistence issue is with the third floor.
That's
right. A dual management issue is not your concern either then?
I didn't say that. Dual management is my concern, and I think I tried to address that and how we are in fact responding in the presentation here today. It's not working very well. But the key to that particular issue right now is obviously the subsistence issue.
I would say that if the pitfalls of a dual management system aren't presented properly, and all we do is concentrate on a subsistence question, the issue becomes subsistence, and we ignore the fact that we're going to fall into a problem of dual management because we're concentrating on subsistence, which it only encompasses the use of 4% of our state's resources. We're going to end up with dual management. I predict that we're going to end up with dual management because the focus isn't on what problems we're going to end up with. We're focusing on subsistence and the problems of subsistence because it only takes up 4% of our resources. We should be concentrating on what dual management will mean to the state of Alaska, and we should be saying that we're an owner state and we will not condone it. But the focus isn't on dual management. It seems to be on just 4% of our resources and the subsistence question.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think that at least in my presentation, I've tried to indicate that we're being influenced from a large number of areas by federal legislation, the most recent of which is the challenge from the federal government under ANILCA and the subsistence priority. So, we've got the Endangered Species Act, we've certainly got the Marine Mammals Act, we've got a number of federal pieces of legislation that impact us on this. At the present time, certainly the subsistence provisions are, the federal challenge is and the state is not challenging subsistence. The state is challenging what the federal government is attempting to do under the subsistence priority in terms of the preemption in navigable waters. All of these are part of the issue that the senator has raised here on this thing. They're all important issues to us, and I've tried to impress that upon the committee here today on this. I think that from our standpoint, we're addressing this in-house at the present time. As we've tried to say, we need additional legal help, and we feel that there has to be some challenges to the federal government, such as the senator is recommending here.
But the problem, I guess, that I have, Mr. Chairman, if I might interrupt, if that is a major issue, why isn't it even listed as something that is of importance to the department? It's not listed. You have you have Canadian negotiations, you have treaties, but you don't even mention a major issue of that we're going to be facing in dual management. That's going to hit us slap right in the face, and we're going to end up with it because of, rightfully, I think the subsistence question should be up in the governor's office, and he should be trying to address it. But that doesn't mean we should be ignoring the pitfalls of dual management.
I think, Mr. Chairman, one last comment. In my view, I think that the importance of the issue was certainly there in my testimony before you here today. From the beginning to the end, that's been the core of my testimony and the importance of that particular issue. The fact that it's not in the document there on that does not detract from the importance of the issue.
I'd like, for the record, because games were played, to note that Senator Hoffman and Senator Petula are here at 10:25 in this meeting. I see little fun games come up from time to time when you miss sessions. I know there's going to be you've generated a number of questions too. Exigencies of time being what they are, you can never really get across program in an hour, an hour and a half. And these short sessions don't provide much opportunity for us to learn enough to sometimes make a false decision that is needed. Any errors and oversights, or maybe I shouldn't say errors, but any oversights or any lack of presentation that you think all the senators should have, I would certainly, one, be available to bring you back. I would ask for your, without request, just a blanket request to inform us new and different changes in the international scene in the coming months, as well as these areas of interest that have been discussed here. Anything that we can get in memo form or fax form is going to be of value to us. Senator Hoffman is chairman of the subcommittee, but I am a member of it. But I think everybody is about as interested in the Fish and Game Department, this whole department, as any other department that exists in state government. Most of us are resident experts to begin with. And so we have a lot of... Carly, I thought you made a real good presentation. I appreciate the people coming here. And if I had more members here, I think there would be some other questions that we have, but I see it's kind of beating the... We may as well go to subcommittee or come back another time rather than just ask them. Some members will read the transcript, but most will not because they have other things to do and are pressured every 15 minutes with constituents or something else. We'll adjourn at this time, but I thank you for all for coming and for this initial presentation. I think that we'll be pretty active subcommittee this year. We'll probably start pretty early, depending on the chairman's wishes there. I expect again to meet with you at least one more time in committee on some of these questions that we do have. Do you have any statements, or anybody that's out there in the group that you brought has anything they wish to add? I'd entertain it, however, before we...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe that I do, or my staff, other than say thank you. We appreciated the opportunity to be here. We're glad to meet with the subcommittee or the full committee at any time at your request. So.
Again, if there's any other meetings that come up that are teleconferenced out of your office that you think might be of interest to the subcommittee especially, please let me know. You can just fax me over with an hour's notice.
Be glad to do it.
Are you saying at 1 o'clock today in your auditorium? Or
yes.
Your,
yes, in my
and that's
auditorium.
A teleconference?
Yes.
And it's on the false pass fishery.
That's correct.
And you're meeting essentially with the Board of Game?
The Board of Fish.
Yeah. We may want to send somebody to that. people. This is the first morning we haven't had people, but I know even myself, I'm supposed to be testifying someplace else right this moment. So that's, some of the members undoubtedly are.
Mr. Chairman, we appreciate the opportunity to participate in this budget overview of the Department of Environmental Conservation. And in a prepared statement, I've summarized my responses to the January 31, 1992 letter raising specific questions on issues. And attached to this statement is a summary of the funding and personnel positions associated both with the fiscal year 93 and fiscal year 92 two budgets. I have with me chief staff division directors that will supplement this testimony and also be available to respond to any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. And if you need coffee or tea or anything,
you want to love a cup of coffee.
Let's get that for him. We'll just stay in advance. So again, you want a regular cup, Commissioner? We can get you.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay.
That's another paper product. It's recyclable and.
I accused him of destroying the forest here about a half minute ago, so he's getting back at me. He's going to reuse all this.
Mr. Chairman, your letter of January 31 identified most of the critical issues that are of also concern to the administration, and I'd like to simply address each of them and then ask the staff to add any additional comments and of course be available for questions. With regard to wetlands, the administration has made a major commitment to bring the responsibility for management of wetlands back to Alaska. The governor wrote to President Bush last year, and in a response from the White House, the White House said they heard the concerns that Alaska had would stem primarily from the fact that less than 1%, indeed less than 0.5% of Alaska's wetlands have been modified or destroyed for development purposes, in contrast to the conditions in the lower 48. So, the White House acknowledged this unique situation in Alaska, and the President in his August 1991 Wetlands Policy Statement recognized this and said that Alaska would be all states having less than 1% of their wetlands.
Yesterday during your hearing, and I don't intend to interrupt you, but just one thing from yesterday that carries over in your testimony last night. Has the proposed Regan set aside a regulation for 90 days in any way affected any major activities that you're now involved in? Is there a relaxation of certain types of federally directed or regulatory functions that you may well be assisted in? You see the news, really, is the only information we have. That they were going to set aside a whole vast number of close onerous regulations for 90 days.
I'm not aware of
okay,
the
that. Okay, I just wanted to say. Thanks very much.
Okay. Continuing on then with this wetland situation, the purpose of our wetlands initiative is to develop state and local regulations as opposed to federal regulations, which are administered by the Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency. And what we want to do is to develop state and local regulations that meet the tailor-made conditions of the different geographic areas of the state. And our intent is to work to have the state and local governments work cooperatively with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Corps of Engineers in inventorying, classifying the different types of wetlands, and then developing regulations that are appropriate to the state. The DEC has developed two federal funding grant requests, one I think for $1 million from the EPA, and the other a $350,000 request. related to coastal zone management grants, and we're exploring some other federal grant proposals, so possibly even asking the congressional delegation to support the Corps of Engineers for funding for special initiatives in classifying the wetlands in Alaska. This whole effort, Mr. Chairman, is well coordinated between the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Natural Resources, Fish and Game, and the Division of Governmental Coordination in the Governor's Office.
How does the Division of Governmental Coordination work with you on this?
Well, they're involved in several ways. Of course, they do all of the coastal zone management activities which involve any wetlands, but the Division of Governmental Coordination also takes the different views of the different departments and offers suggestions and coordinates the policy positions. So on the various issues that arise, they have that coordination role. Anyway, your letter asked specifically about the Soil and Water Conservation Board and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. That should be noted are very heavily involved in the classification of agricultural and other lands. And the Department of Natural Resources, of course, works with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and Boards, and we believe that they should be partners in this process of inventorying, classifying, and prioritizing wetlands. So,
I agree with you.
Why don't I just simply, there's a paper in your handout that elaborates on this wetlands issue, but for the purpose of this summary, maybe let me just continue on and or would you prefer a discussion, a more detailed discussion of this wetlands question, Mr. Chairman?
I think you can continue on because those of us will either come to subcommittee or bring people back in on the wetlands question as it occurs to us without trying to interrupt your continuity too much. I think we're the key interrupter here.
Okay.
So just proceed the way you want to. You will trigger, some of us, speaking for myself, don't have enough knowledge of some of these subjects at this time to even ask the questions. So you will trigger questions undoubtedly as you go along. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, questions 2, 3, and 4 in your January 31 letter relate to the oil and hazardous substance release from the so-called 470 fund.
And on that one, I might want to ask the question too as you go along.
Okay. This past year, early this past year, I ordered an internal audit of the 470 fund, and the results of that audit were made available last May. And the recommendations stemming from that audit were incorporated in the management and update of this fund. The Department of Environmental Conservation, I think week before last, also presented to the legislature, all the members, the annual report, which covered not only fiscal year 1991 activities, but also summarized progress on the implementation of the recommendations of the internal audit report. The fiscal year 92 and the fiscal year 93 proposed response fund allocations are also listed in this, as you pointed out, we have many publications and papers there, and it's not because we just want to cut trees and utilize paper, Mr. Chairman, but we want to be sure you have all this information. But anyway, within
we can use the information in this area, but
within this, let's see, I guess they do not have this. Anyway, in the second section, it covers the funding allocations for both for 92 and 93.
Is that project activity?
Yes, FY92 project activity, the second blue separation. And this also includes a discussion of the contaminated site issue. And Mike Conway, Cell Prevention and Response Director, is the designated 470 fund manager, and with your permission,
please bring anybody to the table you want.
I'd like you to briefly summarize, if you would, Mike, the question that is covered in the committee chair of January 31, 1982 letter.
I'm really also concerned what the department has now decided is through regulations, through looking at the law, is 470 responsibilities and what may need to be actually enacted to broaden those responsibilities if and when the need arises, which it probably has. I've monitored the fund because I authored the legislation, and so I kind of have a legislative history and background for it. And I want to always be sure there's sufficient funding. Last year, as you know, the legislature set aside the opportunity by statute to utilize some portion of the fund for construction of certain facilities, ferry vessels, that could participate in these emergencies. Some portion of that construction could come out of this fund. That's just one thing. But it was done statutorily with full knowledge, so that I'm kind of interested where the fund expenditures are going and what the department envisions them to be, what the department envisions to be legal in expenditures and in the framework of the law.
Mr. Chairman, the internal audit recommended that we take tighter control of the 470 fund and actually designate a specific manager who has the control and responsibility for protecting and managing that fund. And this is Mike Conway, who is the director of Cell Prevention and Response Division, and is the fund manager. Mike, would you like to summarize the points that the Chairman made?
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Chairman. My name is Mike Conway, and I am the director of the Cell Prevention and Response Division. And with that responsibility, I have the responsibility of being the fund manager. This has been a recent designation by the commissioner, so our staff is getting geared up to monitor the fund and develop procedures and policies to provide those tighter controls that the commissioner mentioned.
We'd like to have those as you go along. The session is a very short one. I just kind of like to know what is going on. So if you develop those, even if they're not quite formulated, I have enough sense to realize they're not totally finished, but I kind of like to see the tenor at some stage. 6 weeks from now, 2 months from now.
Yes, sir. We'll keep you posted on that because we are working with the legislature as well to keep, make sure the intents and purposes are being met. Within the blue book that the commissioner mentioned before, under the FY93 response fund revenue projections and allocations, we've provided a listing of projected revenues for FY93 and then the proposed response fund allocations. And within that, there has been a tradition set as far as internal uses for DEC on the response fund to make sure it's used for response fund eligible activities. That is prevention, spill prevention, planning, and response activities. More recently, there have been other agencies that have been involved in these activities to assist us. So there's a process that we initiated this past fall to get input from those agencies. They submitted proposed budgets, and we're working with those proposals to develop work plans to ensure that those activities provided by other agencies are response fund eligible and they do provide the assistance that DEC needs. So that process has started, and that's what we're looking to formalize to get that in there. So for instance, within the state and regional contingency planning line item there, there's monies in there for DNR and Fish and Game to provide their support in reviewing contingency plans and participating in drills and exercises.
What percentage is in this case? A third of it?
I'll
doesn't matter if you don't have this
subcommittee or not. I have the amount here if you wish for me to go through that. I have the specific amount. Under that allocation, the Department of Fish and Game has a request in, and we've gone along with their request in this in all of these areas for $122,800. The Department of Natural Resources has $33,900 in that allocation.
And what were they doing with these funding? Helping you? And
they are going to reduce contingency plans from their program responsibilities. That is industry contingency plans. Whenever there's a requirement, a provincial requirement, that vessels and facilities provide these contingency plans for prevention and response to spills, and these plans are sent to DNR and Fish and Game for them to look at plans from their perspective, their program areas. But also, these plans are tested and drilled, so there's money in that allocation for them to participate in those drills.
All right, thank you.
In the item for spill prevention, response plan, safety cleanup, and cost recovery, we have amounts in there for Fish and Game at $127,200. DNR has $97,800, and law has $250,000 for cost recovery. And those activities are, we're implementing a comprehensive oil pollution control program to fulfill the requirements imposed by the state oil spill prevention contingency planning legislation. So these are the level of funds where they will help us out in those areas. The next item down is the State Emergency Response Commission, and this is composed of the commissioners of the agencies involved in emergency response activities plus public members. And within that allocation, we have a $5,100 amount for Fish and Game. DNR has $8,800. Law has $50,000, and labor has $4,000. And Health and Social Services has $65,500. Community and Regional Affairs has $10,000, and that's the extent of the support for those agencies. The big item that we have on this sheet that I'm referring to is the Spill Response Office Depots and Cores, and there's a $5 million amount in there for Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Division of Emergency Services for establishing the depots and cores in FY93. We're looking at a more aggressive approach. There are hazard analyses being done by the local emergency planning committees that we want to be able to come July 1st to be able to start to set up those depots and cores. The other amounts that are in here are pretty much tracking with previous years.
Senator Duncan, do you have this particular instrument?
Yes, sir.
Okay, excuse me, I just wanted to see you go.
The other point that I'd like to point out, Mr. Chairman, is that there's a need to have a spill reserve to respond to catastrophic spills, and what we're projecting on this sheet here is almost a $31 million spill reserve based upon the revenue projections and the allocations that we have listed. We feel it's very important that we have this reserve. That right now in FY92, the spill reserve is about $12 million. $10 million of that is designated to go to the communities and for their needs in the oil mayor's legislation. So if we're looking at $10 being set aside for that, and that.
How did they get into it? I know they're hustling into it.
How'd
the oil mayor's call?
Senate Bill 25 is the bill that does end.
And it allows them to get funding from this specific funding source.
From the 470 fund, and it would be related to their activities in the event of a spill.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the honey and a bunch of bears.
Anyway, what we're projecting here is for an amount to be able to provide the capability for the state to respond to catastrophic spills. That's a quick overview of this page. there have been, there was a question raised within the letter.
Senator Chairman Fischel has a question.
On what was the, do you remember just in rough numbers what the figure was last year for site investigation, safety cleanup, and cost recovery?
It was in the neighborhood of about $36 million, $3,600,000 in that neighborhood. So, yeah.
So when on your FY92 contaminated sites in process, that I'm trying to relate. I mean, last year we, you know, authorized a, you know, fairly extensive list of site cleanup, and it, and when you just eyeball the 92 list, clearly, I mean, it's not a lot of money, or not a lot of money compared to that category. Are there more sites that are going to be initiated in 92 that haven't yet been initiated?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what we've got is an amount that we're looking to upgrade our activities for the contaminated sites program to initiate more actions, and we've put more money in for 93, and we're looking at having some non-firm systems to be able to take a big chunk out. In 92, what has happened is that there was a sites list that was developed March 31st, as I recall. They had a number of contaminated sites on it before 70-time usage. Since that list was developed, there's been a priority ranking model developed, which realigns the ones that are more emergent nature. In addition to that, their responsible party cleanups have jumped, that the people who have accepted responsibility, initiated their own actions to resolve the situation, and they're paying for it, has increased. So there's been increased activity by staff throughout the state to monitor the responsible party sites. We're able to do in the neighborhood of about 15 of those sites per staff person, yet a state-led site, which was on the March 31st list, is much more involved and intensive. There are no state-led sites that are being neglected that are of imminent problems to health and safety.
We don't have to go into this here, but in the subcommittee, I think we do want to, you know, look through that list and have an explanation of what happened to those sites and what the total amount budgeted for that category were last year versus the reality of what we're doing, and then look at this 4.6 million figure, look at sites anticipated to be initiated or cleaned up next year and how those relate to this entire system.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'd be happy to do that. We're developing a 10-year plan right now, and it's in draft form, and we're looking at it's a strategic plan to get them all taken care of in a 10-year period, and we've got the specifics for 93, so we'd be happy to do that.
And does the administration propose that we have areas in Alaska that can process or store, let's say, there's varying degrees of hazardous materials? I don't personally consider grease oil spills in a very dry, sandy area alone be that much of a disaster, particularly if they're very modest, and fuel tanks and so on, those kind of locations aren't going to saturate down to the water table. You pick up that stuff, you have to ship it outside, I've been told, and that may not be true, for decontamination, et cetera. It seems to me there ought to be several well-located sites in Alaska, one either for, and there may be, for storage of this material so it can someday be processed as there gets to be a sufficient amount for some economy of scale or what. And I may be completely misinformed. It's kind of off the street information if you have to ship it out, but I certainly need locations to store this kind of non-fluid material suspended.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, your recollection and information is correct. The RCRA, or Resource Conservation Recovery Act, designates hazardous waste by specific materials. Oil, which is not one of the products, but of the hazardous waste that fall under this RCRA classification, these must be disposed of in the federally approved sites, treatment and disposal sites. There are no such sites in Alaska, and we have initiated the process with the department with the Environmental Protection Agency. They endorsed our proposal to establish one, two, or three such sites in the state. We believe perhaps the first ought to be located somewhere in the rail belt area or accessible to the rail belt region. And that site be actually as much a treatment as a disposal site, utilizing new technologies. It should be noted that this process requires requirements for siting under stringent state and federal laws. The Department of Environmental Conservation, Natural Resources, and Department of Conservation Public Affairs are examining potential sites. We expect to have some sites identified perhaps by the fall. There has to be a series of public hearings, analysis of the water table, geographic, ecological conditions at these locations, and the EPA tells us it would probably not be until the spring of 1994 at the earliest that an approved site could possibly be established. We're also looking, Mr. Chairman, at the opportunity to have the site or sites administered privately as they are, as the one in Oregon is administered, and that's
domestic fuel tanks. There's certainly thousands, certainly hundreds, but a thousand. A lot of constituents, as you know, you convert to gas and so on. Now, yesterday, and I had a question, and often going to get off of this, and that's the role. But it seems to be the person about to purchase the house is concerned, at least they pick up the liability. The seller was, you know, he converted to gas years ago. You see two pipes going out the basement wall. Now, I don't want to get illegal, but who, if the person would go in there and dig that out, put it in the dump truck, two, three loads, get a test on if it's further contamination in the soil, where can he go with that type of material? Say he's got, let's be modest, 15 yards of it. Where does he go with that kind of material? Does it have some diesel oil or fuel oil spill? Is there a location you can go dump that in? That you said oil is an exception to hazardous waste, and I don't know if diesel oil is or not.
Yeah, that's right. We can get into this subject now. That's covered in the fifth question on underground.
Okay.
And we treat both underground private tanks differently than commercial tanks. With your permission, maybe you can finish this.
Yeah, please proceed. I'll tie into my question.
Just to close off this hazardous waste treatment site and this issue of contaminated sites that Senator Pershaw mentioned, these 900 sites. It should be noted that on the Defense Department's plan, and formerly used Defense Department sites, there are over 400, I think close to 500 contaminated sites identified. The cleanup responsibilities for those on the existing Defense Department sites are the responsibility for funding by the federal government, and Defense Department agencies receive more than $1 million for environmental protection actions, including this item. For formerly used department sites, Mr. Chairman, Corps of Engineers have a responsibility for that, and they do not have the funding to aggressively deal with that program. Perhaps that's enough for about that particular subject. Mike, do you want to continue with this section?
Sure. Question number two, you asked for how much of the 477 allocations for 92 have been extended or obligated, and to provide a listing. I have a listing here. In the interest of time, provide that list.
Hey, can you pick up this list? You can.
I'll provide additional copies if there's they're not enough. But it goes through. There are expenditures being made, and it's we're getting off of the ground as the fund manager for the accounting system. So I guess in the interest of time, unless there's any specific questions at the moment on this, we can go on to number three.
Sure. Great to see.
In question number three, what steps are followed and what criteria are applied in setting the agency's allocation of 470 funds for DEC and the Division of Emergency Services Logistics? We have within the response fund revenue projection and proposed response fund allocation for 93 in the middle of the blue book, booklet there. We have we've gone through a process of going out to the other agencies, as I mentioned before, to get their input as far as what they needed for their activities in support of DEC in response planning, preparedness, and cleanup activities. There, within that is the amount of the $5 million that I mentioned before that Division of Emergency Services has requested. Division of Emergency Services has provided us a rough outline of how those expenditures would be done, and we're in the process of working together a joint work plan with DEC staff and the Division of Emergency Services on depots and cores. There hasn't been any criteria established as of this point. I referred to earlier the process of getting into the fund management procedures and policies that we're developing, which we'll establish. But up to this point, it's all been done on work plans and negotiations back and forth between staff of the projects that are supported by the different agencies. The question number four refers to what is the agency's position on the use of 470 funds to clean up contaminated sites statewide. The 470 fund is used for cases where there are orphan sites or state-led cleanups. That is, there's no responsible party identified, or the responsible party is not able to conduct a cleanup with the resources that he or she has. So the 470 funds are used for those activities. Again, we go through and prioritize the sites on a hazard ranking model system. And I don't see that there are any problems with somebody not deciding to use that fund for those activities. They're considered a threat to health and safety. So that's very well from our
opinion. No questions, please continue.
I should probably inform Mr. Chairman and members of this committee of a specific problem or situation that Senator Phelps has called to my attention earlier this week, and that is on this Alaska Battery Enterprises site, the lead contaminated site in Fairbanks, and the status of that. Over the past two decades, the batteries were in accord with accepted practice at that time, bought for that particular facility, and exchanged and new batteries purchased. The state of Alaska and other parties took batteries there, and unfortunately, the technology practice at that time was to empty the contents of the batteries in the ground. In some cases, the batteries were used as landfill, which led to the contamination of the site. The cost of cleanup, which is being a hazardous waste, is well in excess of $1 million. I think it's close to two. But in any case, the parties responsible for this must reimburse the Environmental Protection Agency for those costs. And this is a tremendous expense shipping this material south. The Environmental Protection Agency met with the responsible parties and citizens of the Fairbanks area last month, and the process is underway to try to recover these monies. The status of that now is, after this public meeting was discussed, the Environmental Protection Agency made a proposal to in effect, treat the orphan batteries, that portion of the site contaminated by orphans, so-called orphan batteries, in one way, identified the principal parties, and then had a de minimis recovery fee for those who just brought a relatively few batteries to that site. The question remains as to what degree the state is responsible for its share of batteries contaminating that site over the funding of DOT and other state agencies. It's a substantial amount of money. And the state, through the Department of Environmental Conservation, will be through its attorney consulting with the Environmental Protection Agency on trying, of course, to minimize the cost of the state's liability in this regard. It's also possible for the responsible parties to jointly get together and to try to work with the Environmental Protection Agency in minimizing the cost of this reimbursement. Mr. Chairman, the DEC's position is the Environmental Protection Agency should share in absorbing some of these costs. There's some evidence that perhaps the shipping of this material south was not the best way of treating this material, but could have been perhaps encased in highway colors and other forms of disposal that would not have required the system itself. Nonetheless, the attorneys tell us, Mr. Chairman, that the courts are very clear, essentially, what the EPA has suspended and can be recovered, and really isn't much recourse except to negotiate. We also believe that perhaps the state should, with the Environmental Protection Agency, share a part of the cost disposal represents kind of the waste from the so-called orphan batteries. But anyway, the status of that is that this is now at the stage of the Environmental Protection Agency wanting to recover funds expended, and that's about where we are. I do not know the potential level of the state's liability in this regard, but I suspect it's well over $100,000, maybe more of that. So, any questions with regard to these subjects on 2, 3, and 4?
Going back to the underground storage tank.
Our next subject.
What?
That's our next.
Oh, I thought you were in 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Sorry.
I guess there's no further questions at this time of that subject.
On this underground storage tank, I wanted to make a few general remarks about the programming, and then after Mike and perhaps Janet and Eric to add to this. The federally funded underground storage tank, the so-called UP program, provides technical assistance in courtesy inspection to tank owners and provides staff support for state program approval to the Environmental Protection Agency. The federally funded leaking underground storage tank project is responsible for overseeing corrective action at sites where release has occurred from a commercial underground storage tank. The storage tank assistance project also protects the public from contamination resulting from leaking underground storage tanks through a newly created regulatory assistance program, which includes prevention, education, and cleanup. With guidance from the Board of Storage Tank Assistance, state financial assistance is provided for conducting site assessments and testing tanks for clean up leaking tanks and sites of septic. So the storage tank assistance project is also responsible for regulations governing the certification of tank workers and site assessors, installation, registration, maintenance, leak detection, site assessments, upgrade, cleanup, and closure of tanks and tank systems is also governed by regulations under the project. The storage tank assistance program was funded at $6.7 million in fiscal year 92 with general funds. In fiscal year 93, the DEC's budget includes a like amount also from the general fund. We have considered other funding sources, such as the surcharge on petroleum fuel. However, because the amount of motor fuel tanks and fuel taxes collected in Alaska falls short of the level needed to support highway maintenance, the administration is not supporting this as a funding source at this time. In recognition of the importance of this program to Alaska's many small tank owners, however, the administration is supporting HB 264, introduced last item by the House Finance Committee, which would allow funding of this program from the 470 fund.
Mr. Chairman, in response to some specific questions of question number five, the underground storage tank regulations were adopted in final form on August 21st of 91. We are focusing our efforts on the financial assistance portion of the regulations at this time as a way to bring facilities into compliance with cleanup and upgrading standards. Up to this time, as of yesterday, we had a little over $1 million that had been awarded in grants, and we expect we're in the process of processing an additional $4 million in grants before the end of the fiscal year. You asked if the department made substantial progress in compliance by owners of these facilities. The department has made substantial progress in bringing owners and operators into compliance with the state and federal underground storage tank law. The financial assistance program has provided monetary incentives for owners and operators to come into compliance. Tanks must be registered, closure notices filled, and assessment reports made for an applicant to receive financial assistance to pay for the cost of tank closure. The activities supported by the financial assistance program themselves, such as upgrading tanks and cleanup of contaminated sites, are bringing these facilities into compliance as well. We have had in the requests that have come into the department as of the end of December for the next year has come in at the level of about $30 million, and that's, we're in the process of reconciling those requests. So everybody is aware of the program, and they're coming to us to try and get in compliance. The next question there was,
what would you do then, say you have a $30 million identifiable demand, all legitimate, and you get $5 million, do you then give everybody 20% or X percent, 1/6 rather?
Mr. Chair, the Board of Storage Tank Assistance will make that decision on it. We'll go through and prioritize the activity and make recommendations, but it will be, as was done this past year, is to go through and get the basic bases covered so that there's no problem that we haven't controlled.
And if we're sure, do you have a question to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every year I'm reminded of my own memory of things that get worse and worse, and I also still don't quite understand some of these funding source explanations in the budget. But how you got, I was just looking at this on the short form, how you presented this funding for the storage tank assistance program is still baffling. My memory is that there was a real live general fund appropriation of the $5.5 million in 91. Last year, we authorized the retention of program receipts collected through the inspection, which brought you up to this $6 million plus figure. That's not a new appropriation in 92, except for the retention of program receipts. This year, you say you put forward another $6 million in general fund. Well, first,